Hello, and welcome to the lecture entitled Learning to Trust Intuitive Wisdom About Eating, a Nutrition Therapist's Approach to the Healing of Eating Disorders. I am Elise Resch, and my credentials include a Master of Science degree in nutrition, and I'm a registered dietitian and a fellow of the American Dietetic Association. My academic institutional affiliation is private practice. I am delivering this presentation to empower you with information and resources when suffering from or assisting individuals struggling with eating disorders. I hope that you find this information helpful. I am so pleased to share with you the insight I have garnered after 25 years of working with some of the brightest, most interesting people you could ever hope to know. I have seen them come in feeling tortured, broken, and hopeless in their relationship with food and walk out physically healthy, feeling whole again. In fact, I recently ran into a former client who said she wouldn't be alive today if not for our work. She said, "I saved her life." Don't think for a minute that I saved her life. I simply helped her save her own life. I believe that an eating disorder is a message from the soul that something is out of balance in life, and that people who suffer with eating disorders have been able to find their voice and speak about their pain only through the metaphor of their eating disorder. I have sat in my office as a witness to this voice and to this pain, offering a safe, non-judgmental, loving arena for them to ponder and cry and express frustration and impaired self-esteem, to offer scientific information for them to take in, incorporate, and use to challenge old, distorted thinking about eating and about their body image, and to give them a viewpoint that expresses an understanding that what they are doing with their eating and with their bodies is actually a coping mechanism in a world where they know no other way to cope, and that rather than being wrought with only negatives and bodily damage, their behavior is also filled with positive nuances, because, as I believe, we don't do anything for no good reason. Today, I would like to talk with you about three main areas of concern and learning. We will be looking at the precursors to the development of an eating disorder and some of the secondary gains that actually perpetuate the desire to maintain the eating disorder, some of the physiological and nutritional consequences of eating disorders, and then, in a positive note, a model of normal eating and acceptance of normal body weight toward which treatment for eating disorders can be geared. The title of this talk is Learning to Trust Intuitive Wisdom About Eating. Eating disorders are about not trusting this wisdom. In fact, an eating disorder is a crisis of trust, not trusting the universe to give you what you need, not trusting that there will be enough love and nurturance to soothe the pain of living in a world where you have so little power and where so much is out of your control. As a reaction to this, we often respond by trying to control the only thing we seem to have any potential to control, that is, what we put in our mouths and how much or how little of it we eat. And in this manner, we are given a sense that we do have some power in this frightening, depriving world we live in. And, as will become evident, with each effort to control food comes an equal and opposite period of being or feeling out of control. Have you ever watched a toddler at play? He can be fully absorbed in his toys and the fantasies in his head when, suddenly, he stops, jumps up, and calls out, "I'm hungry." If his mom tries to stop his play to get him to eat before he's hungry, he'll resist the food and show no interest in eating. But when he feels a hunger pang, stopping the hurting tummy becomes the only thing on his mind. He'll go to the table, start eating his lunch, and continue until the hunger is satisfied, at which time he's out of there as fast as he can, leaving a few bites of his peanut butter sandwich, a carrot stick, a few grapes, and half a cookie. Now, have you ever left over half a cookie? Why do you think this child is able to eat in this way, and that many of the people you know, whether patients, friends, or even yourself, struggle with their relationship with food on a regular, even sometimes moment-to-moment basis? What happens between the early years of eating as a baby or a toddler and later in life to create such obsession and anguish, and even for some, a life-threatening or health-threatening eating disorder? I believe that most people are born with all the information that they'll ever need to have about eating, and that little by little, as years go by, layers of debris form around that pure experience they have with their free-flowing natural signals of hunger and fullness and taste discrimination. This debris begins to cloud their thoughts and feelings and numb these signals, depriving them of the beautiful experience that eating should be. How does this debris begin to build? Unfortunately, it can begin in infancy if the child's caregiver is overly anxious about the child's growth and tries to push in more food than he needs to meet his hunger needs. How many of you came from homes that belonged to the Clean the Plate Club? Or the opposite experience can happen. The caregiver may be overly concerned about his or her own weight and then transfer these concerns to the child, limiting the amount of food given to the child in the attempt to control the child's weight. The great majority of my clients who are overweight as adults report mothers who were on diets and food restrictions put on them in childhood. This debris can also, unfortunately, begin if the pediatrician comments on the child's weight, pushing buttons in the parents. In a recent documentary on HBO called Thin, which examines the lives of four women with anorexia in an inpatient treatment program, one specifically says that it all began when the pediatrician asked her mother, "What are we going to do about your daughter's weight?" The girl had had no sense before that her weight was a problem. If, on the other hand, the child is lucky enough to escape childhood with his innate signals intact, the first layer of debris may be formed when schoolmates or their parents make comments about food or body. Or if children get involved in ballet or gymnastics with a teacher or coach who sets a standard of thinness that is below that of the child's. And, of course, the media, whether on TV, probably the most pervasive influence on creating a false image of weight and beauty, or in the movies or fashion magazines, the layers begin to build and the child begins to look to the outside world for messages about how to eat or how to look, rather than listening within to his or her inner voice that speaks about hunger, fullness, and taste preference, or to honor and respect his or her own growth pattern, body shape, and set point weight. And even as things are beginning to improve in some parts of the media, we get double messages which truly confuse us. I got a phone call a few weeks ago from a young woman who told me that she was a model and wanted to know how she could lose 10 to 15 pounds so that she could get more jobs. She said that she was 5'10" and weighed 130 pounds and thought that she was very thin and looked good. But although she was being told that she would be good on the runway, she is also told that she must lose weight in order to get those jobs. This is the perfect example of someone who would have to ignore her normal eating signals and her genetically predisposed normal weight to conform to an external force. So once the debris is formed from outside influences and the waters of the eating relationship get murky, the stage is set for the development of an eating disorder. There are many factors that influence this development, including brain chemistry, familial structure, and societal milieu. But one of the most powerful precursors is a system which has a 95 to 98% failure rate, but that lives and breathes and flourishes and lurks around every corner. That doomed system is the system of dieting, which, in an insidious and malevolent way, can set up the individual for a life of emotional and sometimes physical pain and lowered self-esteem, which pervades every aspect of his or her life. In the midst of writing this talk, I did a counseling session in my office with a client of mine whom I've seen off and on for many years. This is a woman who began dieting as a teenager. The dieting soon led to anorexia and bulimia, and now 30 years since she began dieting, she asked me, "Does anyone ever get over having an eating disorder?" When treatment begins in the early onset of the disorder, or certainly before it ever begins, by helping someone reject dieting, healing is common and often rapid. After 20 or 30 or 40 years, the prognosis is not so hopeful. We will return later to this treatment after we've continued looking at the precursors to eating disorders, as well as some of the physiological consequences. We've talked about the family in terms of the parents' own agenda around food and the child. We've also talked about the celebrity world seen in the media. And by the way, as an aside, I have worked with a good number of these celebrities who have become the role models for our youth and even adults, actresses, singers, models. And if you think that they are happy because of their status and monetary compensation, you are sadly wrong. The fishbowl in which they live, the pressure they are under to maintain a look which is impossible to maintain without constant deprivation and excessive exercise, and sometimes even illegal drugs and diet pills, is enormous. Now, of course, there are a few people who are born with highly active metabolisms, who never have a concern for what they eat or how they move, and have been given genetically a sufficient amount of muscle and an ideal, according to today's standards, body shape. Of course, they would have been out during the Marilyn Monroe or Jane Mansfield era. It is some of these people who are picked for the TV shows and movies. The others, who are not given the same metabolic rate, are the ones who must maintain disordered eating to compete. I had a client come in several years ago who was 97 pounds and 5'7". She did not have anorexia. She was desperate to gain weight. She ate burgers and fries and Cokes all day long, trying to gain weight. She said that everyone thought that she either had anorexia or cancer, and she hated it. And we worked as hard as we could to gain weight. And after weeks of adding more calorically dense, healthy foods to her already dense caloric intake, she gained a pound. A week later, she lost it. So even those who have fast metabolic rates aren't necessarily happy. And by the way, with celebrities again, some of what they're competing with isn't even real. One of my clients recently brought in a magazine to show me a photo spread of her, and pointing to the legs in the picture, said to me quite angrily, "Those are not my legs. I know what my legs and feet look like, and those are not mine." So some of the photos which trigger jealousy and competition are either airbrushed, brushed, cut and pasted, or computer modified. How do you compete with that? Let's now turn to the psychology of the individual within the context of his or her family environment and societal milieu to find the background of another forceful precursor to the development of an eating disorder. If you are a child living in a home where there is constant strife between the parents, or there is another child in the family who is getting attention for a disability, or there is a highly controlling parent, or a subtly or overtly abusive parent, whether it's emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, or if there is a death of a family member, or divorce, or sudden financial bankruptcy, or if you have a learning disability or simply do not have the IQ of your peers and can't compete, or you have the stress of getting into college or leaving home for the first time to go to camp or to college, or a myriad of other emotionally difficult reasons, you might turn to food as a way to comfort, distract, or even numb yourself from the feelings that arise from any of these situations. You might even go so far as to use excessive food intake in a destructive way to punish yourself if you blame yourself for any of these problems. Or you might use food as a vehicle to gain weight to protect yourself from sexual advances or to make a rebellious statement to a parent who is trying to push you to be thin. Or as one of my clients described to me, she gained weight to cover the beautiful body she had developed at 13 because she felt guilty about having it while her mother had been carved away, as she put it, as a result of a double mastectomy. You might even stop eating as a way to maintain an illusion of childhood by losing the evidence of your secondary sexual characteristics, or stop eating so that you are weak and dependent and don't have to go on to the higher responsibilities that come with growing up. Let me be perfectly clear. I said earlier that we don't do anything for no good reason. That statement is a double negative, but it's probably the most important thing you need to know when thinking about someone with an eating disorder. The development, maintenance, and perhaps resistance to recovery from an eating disorder comes from a deep psychic need to cope with the stresses of one's life. People don't want to be miserable. They don't want to suffer, no matter how much pain their eating disorder is causing, no matter how much negative attention it attracts. It is serving them at a higher level to help them get through some greater pain than is caused by the eating disorder itself. One of the most significant keys to the treatment process I have developed to help my patients with their healing is to acknowledge for them and help them learn to acknowledge for themselves this crucial statement. They have developed their eating disorder as a way to cope in a world in which they knew no other way to cope. Others may have used alcohol or drugs or promiscuity or compulsive buying or gambling or even have resorted to suicide to get through the pain in their lives. My patients have chosen food or the resistance of it, usually as their primary coping mechanism. For the majority of my clients, they have never heard this kind of explanation or compassion before. They're usually told by family members or often other professionals that they are killing themselves. How can you do this to yourself? How can you do this to the family, et cetera, et cetera. For the first time, they are hearing that they have been doing this for a good reason, that now, finally, they are going to learn other ways of coping, other ways speaking to themselves and speaking out to others. Other ways to soothe themselves so that little by little their need for the eating disorder will diminish and they will begin to see themselves as whole, balanced, worthy human beings who are survivors. They may have chosen a mechanism for survival that has had some elements of destructiveness, whether physiologically or psychologically, but regardless, at a psychic level, it has been a benefit to them. The healing begins at the moment that this realization takes hold and becomes internalized. As they stop beating themselves up for their overeating, undereating, compulsive exercise, throwing up, etc., and begin to appreciate the disorder as the life jacket they've needed when they didn't know how to swim, they are then ready to start mourning the loss of this friend whom they've known for so long and are now ready to let go. The 40-ish-year-old woman I mentioned earlier, who has been suffering from her eating disorder since she was a teenager, cried in my office the other day because she is letting go of her bulimia. And although she feels free, she told me that she also feels as if she's lost her best friend. So we see that an eating disorder can emerge from one or more, likely, a combination of factors, including a feeding environment in early childhood, which is not respectful to the child's internal cues of hunger, fullness, and taste discrimination, a family structure which creates stress, chaos, or abuse, and does not provide the tools for the child to learn to cope with these situations in a positive way, a culture that promotes an idealized, unrealistic body weight or shape, and or dieting itself, the most unsuccessful paradigm for weight control, which, as I will discuss later, can only lead to deprivation, rebellion, and ultimate loss of control. Let's now look at some of the physiological consequences resulting from eating disorders. A common theme that runs through many eating disorders is starvation and its symptoms. Whether someone is blatantly starving herself through anorexia nervosa, or is eating but then purging food through bulimia, or is dieting and going through a period of reduced caloric intake, the body registers this restriction of energy input as famine and defends itself accordingly. We see low energy levels, low blood sugar symptoms such as lack of concentration, shakiness and mood swings, sleep disturbance, constipation, feeling cold, even when the temperature is normal, loss of hair, slowed stomach emptying leading to feeling bloated or nauseated, modified sense of taste, depressed immune system, loss of muscle and other body proteins, high cholesterol, fluid and mineral abnormalities, vitamin deficiencies, heart abnormalities, slowed metabolism, amenorrhea, that is absence of menstrual periods, and ultimately osteoporosis, lack of bone density. If you think of the body being a fine-tuned machine that is designed to stay in what I like to call homeobalance, you'll understand that not fueling the body will lead to an attempt by the body to conserve energy rather than waste it, and in this attempt to stay alive, to let go of lower-level needs such as maintaining hair or getting periods, probably as a protection against getting pregnant and a pregnancy's added demands on the body. Although many of these consequences cause a great deal of discomfort to patients, they're not usually troublesome enough to combat the strong forces that maintain the eating disorder. I can talk to most patients until the moon turns into Swiss cheese about some of these dangers, especially the dangers of osteoporosis as a result of amenorrhea due to lack of sufficient estrogen. I can give example after example of former patients who have 40% reduced bone density after 2 years of amenorrhea, with one horror story after another of broken bones and bent over backs. But it doesn't seem to affect them, as does the threat of what I tell them when I pull out the big guns, and that is the potential for slowed metabolism, which after a long period of time can lead to changes in fat to muscle proportion and an ultimate resultant excessive weight gain. This seems to be the one concern that can get a self-starving person to take in a little more food, because, as we have seen, the pressure to be thin in our culture is so powerful that it will lead people to go to all extremes to achieve and maintain unrealistic low weights. If, however, they are taught that studies have shown a 40% reduction in metabolism with starvation or bulimia, and hear stories about patients who dieted or restricted for years in their youth and end up obese in their middle years, their ears open and the information can lead them to ultimately make some changes. I especially like to tell them about the three patients of mine, each of whom gained 20 pounds in a period of 3 weeks without changing their food intake. that really shocks them. One of the most powerful images that I like to use in treatment to emphasize this point with them is the metaphor of the wood-burning stove. I say to them, imagine that you've gone up to the mountains to go skiing with some friends. You arrive at the cabin, and you open the door and see in the middle of the cabin a stove. And this stove is the only source of heat in the cabin. And the cabin is nice and warm, and people are comfortable, and they decide they're going to leave and go out skiing. And they see a source of wood, and they take some logs and put the logs in the fire. And it starts to rage even higher, and they leave. Come back after skiing, and they walk into the cabin, and it's nice and warm and toasty, and the fire has gone down a bit, so they throw a couple more logs into the fire. By the time they go to bed, the fire's gone down again, they throw a couple more logs in and go to sleep, and the cabin is warm throughout the night, and they're comfortable. They wake up in the morning and are so excited to go out skiing that they forget to put more logs in and rush out the door. When they come back at lunchtime, it's ice cold. The wood-burning stove has stopped burning the wood. The fire is out. They throw some logs in the fire, but there's nothing in there to ignite the logs, and the logs just sit there. I like to use this metaphor because the picture stays with them as they're struggling to eat. They begin to think of food as fuel rather than as a source of fat production, and then to begin to change their relationship with eating. As refeeding begins, we see an initial period of bloating or refeeding edema, gastrointestinal discomfort, especially from the slowed stomach emptying, which, by the way, occurs in the starved state to enable the body to absorb more nutrition from the limited energy intake, and a rapid jump on the scale. I prefer not showing the weight to my patients, as it can really scare them to see the scale jump so quickly. As time goes on and the refeeding becomes more reliable, the water retention stops and the metabolism picks up, sometimes to the point of becoming hypermetabolic, and you'll often see a drop in weight to the original weight, even though the person is eating much more. Eventually, the metabolism returns to a more normal place, as does the weight. With bulimia, we have additional consequences, such as injuries to the esophagus with bleeding, injuries to the stomach causing gastritis, kidney complications, hemorrhages in the blood vessels in the eyes, injuries to the colon due to laxative abuse, and most commonly erosion of the teeth's enamel and dentin due to the increased acid brought up from vomiting. And of course, with compulsive overeating and subsequent obesity as a rebound from dieting, we see all the dangers we've heard about, such as high cholesterol, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, circulation problems, back problems, etc., etc. But again, if these problems were truly motivators to behavior change, we wouldn't have an obesity problem in this country. Which brings me back to the title of this talk, Learning to Trust Intuitive Wisdom About Eating, a nutrition therapist's approach. Remember that toddler about whom I spoke at the beginning, the one who was only interested in eating when he was hungry and went back to his toys when he was full, leaving some food over? That small child is the model for the intuitive eater, which I have written about in the book Intuitive Eating, which I co-authored. As we start to strip off all of those layers of debris from societal standards, familial pressures, and the diet police noise which can be found in every patient I've ever had with any form of disordered eating, we find emerging that intuitive eater with which each of us is born. And as we start to address the emotions that trap all of us in this life, the fears of not having enough, of not being able to control our destinies, of being lonely, not good enough, not smart enough, not rich enough, not thin enough, and learn that no amount of food intake or restriction can ever soothe these fears for long enough or solve these anxieties, that being with our feelings, sitting with them, waiting for them to calm, for the ebb and flow of life to make its own changes and resolve many of the fears, only then can we discover that listening to your intuitive signals, the higher wisdom that only you have about eating, can create a safe place for your relationship with food and heal your eating disorder. By the way, I want to state right here that I work with psychotherapists on a regular, ongoing basis with all of my patients with eating disorders, so that they can work on these fundamental issues in therapy, while I am helping them learn to feed their bodies and challenge their distorted myths about eating. So, now that we know about the precursors to eating disorders and the resultant gruesome consequences, I'd like to take you on a journey and bring you into the life of a perpetual dieter. Many of you may relate to this scenario. You finally found the perfect diet, the one that really works. You've been on it for 3 weeks, have followed it to the T, and have begun to lose some weight. You're stoked. You're confident. You're never going backwards again. Then the phone rings, and one of your best friends invites you to a dinner party on Saturday night for her birthday. Your heart sinks. What are you going to do? You can't disappoint your friend. Yet she's such a good cook. How will you stay on your diet? You quickly tell her that you'll be there. Get off the phone and resolve that no matter what, you will have the willpower to stay on your diet. Saturday night arrives. You've had another good week on the diet, and you are ready to meet and tackle your enemy. Everything goes very well. People are sitting around the coffee table. There are bowls of chips and dip, cheese and crackers, and thank goodness, a platter of crudité. That's the free food raw vegetables allowed on your diet. You start munching away at the celery and carrots, feeling so proud that you're not touching the chips or the cheese. Dinner is now served, and you notice the platter of chicken, the steamed asparagus, mashed potatoes, and dinner rolls. No problem. You'll go for a chicken breast. Of course, you'll pull off the skin. Lots of asparagus and one roll, as you're allowed 2 bread servings in the day and you saved up for this dinner. You'll pass on the mashed potatoes because they probably have butter in them, and you're on a very low-fat diet. Wow, you got through the dinner, were virtuous, and didn't blow it. Notice my language? And then the piece de resistance, so to speak, the birthday cake, a big, beautiful chocolate cake with thick chocolate frosting, your favorite cake. And now the struggle begins in your head. No cake, I can't do that. Oh, maybe one tiny bite. I'll ask for a thin slice and put in my fork just to taste. What can one bite hurt? Great, resolve. And then the piece is in front of you. You take that bite, and you're in heaven. Then maybe just one bite more. Oh, this is such a thin slice. I'll just finish it. Oh, no, I can't believe I ate that piece of cake. I blew it. I've been so good. It must have had 500 calories in that one little piece. It was so rich. Oh, forget it. I'll be good again tomorrow. Since I've already blown tonight, I might as well have another piece. And then, back at the coffee table, who finishes up the last of the chips and starts in on the bowl of M&Ms and nuts that come out after dinner? Ever been there? Then you go home, go to sleep, and wake up on Sunday morning with more recriminations than the football coach after losing the game. And since it's still the weekend, you might as well finish it out, keep eating, and start again on the diet on Monday morning. Of course, Monday morning you get on the scale, have gained back everything you lost during the weeks of dieting, and probably a little more. What just happened here? Abraham Maslow, the psychologist, tells us that we're driven by our unmet needs. When intuitive eating was presented on the Phil Donahue show, Phil said, "That which you deny, you empower." If I'm sitting in my office with a client and her small child, and I put out 37 toys and tell the child that he can play with any of the toys, except the rock on the floor that happens to have intuition engraved on it, the only thing that interests the child is the rock, the one thing he can't have. It is the nature of dieting to include restrictions. There's almost always some food or food group that you're not allowed to have. And, of course, what you can't have, you want, even if it's broccoli or carrots. Deprivation will ultimately, inevitably, lead to rebound overeating. Even the mere hint of future deprivation will lead to this. We call it Last Supper eating. You're about to go on the next diet or are going to return to the one you've just blown, and you have to get in everything that you haven't had or are about to not have. Diets also have another innate mechanism that will ultimately result in rebound overeating. You are the only person who knows when you're hungry, what you want to eat, and when you're full. Diets tell you when you can eat, how much you can eat, and what you can and cannot eat. To me, that is a boundary invasion. The diet steps into your very private, personal place and tells you what to do. And if you've ever been around a 2-year-old or remember your own adolescent years, you will know that it is a very normal, natural reaction to say no when told what to do. This rebellion is not deviant behavior, but a very healthy demonstration of your desire to retain or regain your autonomy when it is threatened by some outside force's attempt to control you. and in this healthy protection of your boundaries and your autonomy, you will exhibit behavior that feels out of control and may become destructive. What a vicious circle. You try to control your food to lose weight. In that process, you feel deprived and rebellious. You disinhibit, and wham, you're out of control, feel powerless and hopeless. Remember the toddler I described earlier, the natural intuitive eater? This child was responding to his own signals of hunger and fullness. He ate what he wanted and just enough of it to satisfy him. No one threatened his autonomy or deprived him of what he liked. In fact, I often advise parents to put all of the food out on the table for their child. The cookies have equal importance to the carrots and the chicken. Nothing is restricted, nothing is overvalued, nothing is pushed. You end up with a child who retains intact all of the intuitive signals about eating with which he was born. If the dieter rejects the whole model of dieting, starts shedding the debris I talked about earlier, he too will be able to return to that natural intuitive eating state. Rather than feeling out of control in this world that offers us so little safety, he will feel empowered from within. He will be able to trust what his body tells him, will not be deprived, and will have no need to rebel and feel out of control. So now you must be wondering about the nuts and bolts of how to become an intuitive eater. There are 10 principles discussed in my book, which I'll go over briefly. We could spend an entire day talking about the nitty-gritty of each principle, but I will at least introduce them to you and give you some guidelines to help you get started. The first principle is called reject the diet mentality. This is number one, because if there is even the slightest thought that if this doesn't work, I'll try that diet that I heard about on TV, you'll be doomed from the beginning. Knowing that you can never diet again, that diets simply don't work, that you can't even think about depriving yourself one more time is crucial to the openness that it takes to start listening within and letting go of the negative police voices that can easily judge you, make you feel bad, and ultimately sabotage you. Here are some guidelines for rejecting the diet mentality. Number one, make a firm commitment to give up dieting for the rest of your life. As long as you hold on to even the slightest thought, promise, or hope that dieting is in your future, you will sabotage your ability to become an intuitive eater. Number two, throw out all of your calorie counters and old diet books and articles. Number three, when friends talk about the newest fad diet, or you see a TV commercial or magazine article on dieting, avoid getting drawn into the excitement that might arise. Instead, take a deep breath and gently assure yourself that you are committed to a new way of thinking and feeling about food and eating, and that dieting is not a part of this new process. Number four, protect your food boundaries by refusing to allow others to tell you what to eat, when to eat, or how much to eat. Protect your body boundaries by refusing to allow others to make comments about your weight and body. If you notice that you're feeling rebellious or beginning to eat unconsciously, check in with yourself to see if you're still holding on to diet thinking and diet rules that are triggering this reaction, or if you're being bombarded by any outside boundary invaders. The second principle is honor your hunger. Keep your body biologically fed with adequate energy and carbohydrates. Otherwise, you can trigger a primal drive to overeat. Once you reach the moment of excessive hunger, all intentions of moderate, conscious eating are fleeting and irrelevant. Learning to honor this first biological signal sets the stage for rebuilding trust with yourself and food. Number one, begin to listen to the smallest noise or feeling that indicates that you are experiencing hunger, such as a growling or grumbling stomach, a slight headache, a lack of mental focus, grouchiness, lack of energy, etc. Number two, as soon as you recognize your biological hunger, make the time to eat. If you neglect this most basic signal and get overhungry, it will be very hard to identify what you really want to eat or when you've had enough. Number four, if you don't seem to experience hunger signals over long periods of time, you might want to try eating every 3 to 4 hours. Eventually, your body will get used to being fed regularly and will begin to provide you with dependable hunger signals. Number five, keep in mind that if you are sick or stressed, hunger signals may be blunted. It's important to feed your body on those days too, even if you don't feel the hunger. Number six, be prepared. be sure to make time for shopping for food, cooking, or picking up pre-made food, and for gathering snacks or even meals to put in a lunch bag or to carry in the car. In this way, you show respect for your body signals and can provide for your needs. The third principle is make peace with food. Call a truce. Stop the food fight. Give yourself unconditional permission to eat. If you tell yourself that you can't or shouldn't have a particular food, it can lead to intense feelings of deprivation that build into uncontrollable cravings and often binging. When you finally give in to your forbidden food, eating will be experienced with such intensity it usually results in Last Supper overeating and overwhelming guilt. Number one, give yourself unconditional permission to eat whatever you really like. Make avocado emotionally equivalent to lettuce and peach pie equivalent to a peach. Number two, beware of giving yourself pseudo-permission by telling yourself that you can eat what you like but continuing to hold guilty thoughts about your food choices. It won't work. Number three, do not deprive yourself of any food that sounds appealing to you. Number four, observe how your body feels when eating this food and how satisfying it is to your tongue. Make a mental note of these experiences for your memory bank. Number five, keep an ample supply of all the foods that you think you might like to eat. Restock the supply when it gets low. Principle four is challenge the food police. Scream a loud no to the thoughts in your head that declare you're good for eating under 1,000 calories or bad because you ate a piece of chocolate cake. The food police monitor the unreasonable rules that dieting has created. The police station is housed deep in your psyche, and its loudspeaker shouts negative barbs, hopeless phrases, and guilt-provoking indictments. Chasing the food police away is a critical step in returning to intuitive eating. Number one, identify your distorted food, dieting, and eating thoughts and myths. Throw them out and replace them with the truth. Listen for the destructive voices which can speak harmful thoughts. The food police voice is harsh and critical and is driven by the dieting mentality. It can be stimulated by listening to the media, parents, and peers. It keeps you at war with your relationship with food and your body. The nutrition informant's voice is judgmental and colludes with the food police. It gives you nutrition facts to help justify your dieting. The diet rebel voice is angry and is born in response to boundary invaders who cross over the line into the private space that holds your intuitive eating signals and feelings about your body. It protects your autonomy while also causing some destructive eating behavior. Number three, develop the helpful voices that can get you through hard times and make your eating relationship more comfortable. First, the food anthropologist's voice quotes neutral observations. It notes your thoughts and actions with respect to your food world to help you make choices about what you want to eat, when you want to eat, and how much you need to eat. It can also record these thoughts in your memory bank so they will be easily accessible when needed in the future to help you make eating decisions. The nurturer voice is soft and gentle and provides soothing and reassuring statements that support you through this process. The rebel ally voice evolves from the diet rebel voice and helps you protect your boundaries against anyone who invades your eating space. The nutrition ally voice replaces the nutrition informant voice when the food police are exiled. It is interested in healthy eating with no hidden dieting agenda. The intuitive eater voice speaks your gut reactions. You were born with this voice, and it gives you messages and answers about your eating that only you can know. It also helps you make decisions that only you have the right to make. Watch out for negative self-talk based on the following irrational beliefs and distorted thinking. This is number four. Dichotomous thinking, thinking in an all-or-nothing black-and-white fashion. Absolutist thinking, magical thinking that believes that one behavior will absolutely affect and control a second behavior. Catastrophic thinking, thinking in exaggerated ways. Pessimistic thinking, or the cup is half empty, where a given situation is seen in its worst-case scenario. And linear thinking, thinking in a straight line, allowing for no variables, focusing on the end results. Replace number five, replace negative self-talk with positive self-talk based on rational thinking. Some examples of rational thinking include living in the gray, that is, moderate thoughts, not black and white. Permissive thoughts and statements. Accurate, non-exaggerated thoughts. The cup is half full thoughts, creating the best case scenario. And process thinking. Focus on continual change and learning, prioritizing the means rather than the end. The fifth principle is feel your fullness. Listen for the body signals that tell you that you are no longer hungry. Observe the signs that show that you're comfortably full. Pause in the middle of a meal or food and ask yourself how the food tastes and what is your current fullness level. Number one, pay attention to your fullness signals. But remember, the only way that you can do this is to give yourself unconditional permission to eat. You must firmly believe that you will be able to eat again when you get hungry in order to be able to stop when you're full. Number two, be sure to honor your hunger. If you're over-hungry, your urgency to eat will create great difficulty in recognizing your fullness signals. Equally, if you begin eating before true hunger arises, your fullness signals will be muted. You're likely to be guided by your tongue instead of your stomach. Number three, discard the notion that you must finish everything on your plate because you fear wasting food. Far more damage can be done to your body and your psyche by eating extra food than by discarding it. Number four, increase your consciousness in order to help you identify satiety. Try eating without distraction so that you can be fully present during your meal. Pause in the middle of a meal or snack and take a time out to check your fullness level. This is not a commitment to stop eating, but a commitment to check in with your body and taste buds. Take a taste check. Ask, how does the food taste? Does it meet your expectations? Is it satisfying your taste buds? Or are you continuing to eat just because it's there? Take a satiety check. Pay attention to the signals that your stomach gives you to indicate that you're becoming comfortably full. Ask, what's my hunger or fullness level? Am I still hungry? Is hunger going away? Do I feel insatiable? Am I beginning to feel satisfied? Identify the last bite threshold. This is the end point. You know that the bite of food in your mouth is the last. Don't worry if you can't do this at first. It will ultimately become intuitive. If you feel disappointed that you have to stop at this point, remember, you can eat this food or another food again when your hunger returns. Eating is actually more satisfying when you're comfortably hungry rather than already full. You're giving yourself a gift by stopping now. Make a concrete statement to yourself that you've reached the threshold bite by putting your fork and knife on your plate or by moving your plate forward a little bit. Give your leftovers to the server to wrap up if you're at a restaurant, or put them in the refrigerator if you're at home. Say no thank you firmly to your host or hostess if more food is being thrust upon you. You have a right to say no. Five, make sure that you have plenty of food available for your meals. If you give yourself too little to eat, you'll never feel satisfied or full. You don't need too much food, but too little food will sabotage this process. Number six, select foods that have some substance. If you only choose air foods, such as rice cakes and raw vegetables, you'll get a false sense of satiety, only to get hungry again much too quickly. Feed yourself real food. Principle six is discover the satisfaction factor. The Japanese have the wisdom to promote pleasure as one of their goals of healthy living. In our fury to be thin and healthy, we often overlook one of the most basic gifts of existence, the pleasure and satisfaction that can be found in the eating experience. When you eat what you really want, in an environment that is inviting and conducive, the pleasure you derive will be a powerful force in helping you feel satisfied and content. By providing this experience for yourself, you will find that it takes much less food to decide you've had enough. Give yourself permission to seek pleasure in your eating. The more pleasurable your food is, the more satisfaction you'll derive from your eating experience. The more satisfied you feel, the less you'll need to eat, especially if you know that this food will never be forbidden. Number two, figure out what you really want to eat by paying attention to the following sensations associated with eating. Taste, is it sweet, savory, salty, sour, or bitter that you want? texture. Do you want hard, crunchy, smooth, creamy, etc.? Aroma, sweet, acrid, mild. Appearance, color, shape, eye appeal, etc. Temperature, hot, cold, icy, or temperate. Volume or filling capacity, airy, light, or dense. Number three, think about how your body might feel when you finish eating. Will you be physically satisfied by your choice? Will a dense food make you feel uncomfortably full later, or an airy food leave you feeling empty? Will an overly rich meal give you stomach distress? Will a primarily sweet meal send your blood sugar on a roller coaster ride? Number four, make your eating environment enjoyable. Eat when gently hungry rather than over hungry. Make time to appreciate your food. Create an aesthetic environment. Try pretty placemats, candles, colorful dishes, classical music. Keep the noise level down. Sit down to eat. Take several deep breaths before you eat. Savor your food. Pay attention to eating as slowly as you can. Taste each bite of food that you put in your mouth. Provide variety in your meal. Avoid tension while eating. Number five, don't settle. Eliminate the unenjoyable. If you don't love it, don't eat it. And if you love it, savor it. Number six, check in with your taste buds in the midst of your meal to see if the food still tastes as good as it did when you began. Remember, it doesn't always have to be perfect. Sometimes meals are not in your control. There are many more opportunities ahead for satisfying meals. The seventh principle is cope with your emotions without using food. Find ways to comfort, nurture, distract, and resolve your issues without using food. Anxiety, loneliness, boredom, anger are emotions we all experience throughout life. Each has its own trigger and each has its own appeasement. Food won't fix any of these feelings. It may comfort for the short term, distract from the pain, or even numb you into a food hangover. But food won't solve the problem. If anything, eating for an emotional hunger will only make you feel worse in the long run. You'll ultimately have to deal with the source of the emotion as well as the discomfort of overeating. Number one, ask yourself, am I biologically hungry? If your answer is yes, honor your hunger and eat. Number two, when you find yourself searching for food but know that you're not biologically hungry, take a time out to ask yourself, what am I feeling? Are you scared, anxious, angry, bored, hurt, lonely, depressed? Or are you happy, excited, need a reward, or want to celebrate? To help identify your feelings, spend some quiet time writing in your journal or talking into a tape recorder. Or if it's easier to get in touch with your feelings with another person, call a good friend or understanding relative. You might even need to call your psychotherapist or nutrition therapist. Use email if that's an easier way to communicate. Number three, then ask yourself, what do I need? Do you actually need sleep, a hug, some intellectual stimulation, etc.? Food doesn't appropriately satisfy any of those needs. Number four, in order to get your needs met, ask, would you please? Sometimes for needs to be fulfilled, you'll have to speak up and ask for help. Number five, meet your needs without using food in the following ways. Nurture yourself by taking bubble baths, listening to soothing music, getting a massage, taking a yoga class, buying yourself some flowers, etc. Deal with your feelings. Acknowledge what is troubling you. Allow your feelings to emerge. This will reduce your need to push them down with food. If necessary, provide yourself with a temporary distraction. It's okay to get away from the feelings from time to time, but you don't have to use food for this purpose. Try renting a movie, reading an absorbing book, listening to music, or a book on tape, gardening, etc. Number six, if you have an episode of using food to cope, see it as a red flag that something is going on in your life that needs attention. Whatever you do, don't beat yourself for this behavior. Most people do it at times. Just take it as a learning experience and go on. Principle eight is respect your body. Accept your genetic blueprint. Just as a person with a shoe size of 8 would not expect to realistically squeeze into a size 6, it is equally as futile and uncomfortable to have the same expectation with body size. But mostly, respect your body so you can feel better about who you are. It's hard to reject the diet mentality if you are unrealistic and overly critical about your body shape. Number one, appreciate the parts of your body that you especially like, whether it's your hair, waist, feet, or nose. Number two, take bubble baths and use lotions and creams that feel soothing as you rub them in. Number three, get massages and hugs and caresses that give your body the opportunity to be touched. Number four, get comfortable. Buy comfortable undergarments. Buy clothing that is flattering and fits you without being tight. Number five, don't hide your body in clothes that are too large. Number six, quit the body check game. Stop comparing yourself to everyone else in the room. It blinds you from appreciating yourself and is a setup for more body dissatisfaction. It might even create a temptation to return to dieting. Number six, don't compromise for the big event. Don't succumb to the pressure of dieting down to squeeze into that special outfit. It will only backfire. Number seven, stop body bashing. Every time you focus on your imperfect body parts, it creates more self-consciousness and body worry. When you hear yourself making disparaging comments about your body, replace these comments with kind body statements. Number eight, stop weighing yourself. It can only make you feel discontented with your body. Number nine, respect body diversity, especially yours. Number 10, be realistic about your genetic makeup. Accept your body type and know that your body will balance out at its natural weight when you're consistently listening to your intuitive signals and practicing self-care. Number 11, be understanding of yourself. Respect the fact that you may be higher than your normal body weight if you are someone who has used food to cope when you knew no other way to handle your feelings or because you've been a victim of a diet mentality. Be gentle with yourself and accept that your body is where it is because you have very little choice about these factors. The ninth principle is exercise. Feel the difference. Forget militant exercise. Just get active and feel the difference. Shift your focus to how it feels to move your body rather than the calorie-burning effect of exercise. If you focus on how you feel from working out, such as energized, it can make the difference between rolling out of bed for a brisk morning walk or hitting the snooze alarm. If when you wake up your only goal is to lose weight, it's usually not a motivating factor in that moment of time. Breakthrough exercise barriers. Number one, discover all the reasons behind any exercise resistance that you may have. It may be due to having been teased as a child, having rebelled against authority, feeling intimidated for not having a lean body, lean enough body, etc. Focus on how it feels. Exercise is primarily for feeling good. It so happens that the better you feel, the less you'll need to use food as a way to cope. It can also give you increased energy, a general aura of well-being, a sense of empowerment, and sounder sleep. Disassociate exercise from weight loss. Erase the tape of how exercise felt when you were dieting. Focus on exercise as a way of taking care of yourself, feeling good now, and preventing health problems later in life. Number two, get active in daily living. Make exercise convenient and fun. Park your car a few blocks from your destination so you can add some walking to your day. Walk upstairs instead of using the elevator. Ride your bike or walk to work. When you travel, take walking shoes or a jump rope. Make exercise fun. Consider playing a team sport. Join a gym if having others around you will motivate you. Buy a treadmill or other home exercise equipment and put a TV or VCR or DVD player in front of it so you can tape and watch movies or interesting programs. Listening to music or a book on tape might also make the exercise more fun. Find an exercise partner with whom you can take walks. Make exercise a non-negotiable priority. Be comfortable while exercising and include strength training so you can rebuild muscle that was lost from dieting. And remember rest. Make sure you give yourself days of rest within your exercise week. And finally, principle 10 is honor your health, gentle nutrition. Make food choices that honor your health and taste buds while making you feel well. Remember that you don't have to eat a perfect diet to be healthy. You will not suddenly get a nutrient deficiency or gain weight from one snack, one meal, or one day of eating. It's what you eat consistently over time that matters. Progress, not perfection, is what counts. Number one, consider the tenets of food wisdom: variety, moderation, and balance. As with exercise, consider nutrition as your passport into feeling good. Number two, feed your metabolism. Be sure to stoke your metabolic fire by getting sufficient fuel throughout the day by eating whenever you're hungry. Number three, eat plenty of whole grains, fruits, and vegetables and beans for their fiber content so your digestive tract works well. They're also a powerhouse of vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals. Number four, eat sufficient protein, but not too much, for cellular repair and production of hormones, enzymes, hair, nails, etc. Number five, eat plenty of carbohydrates and sufficient calories so your protein can be used as a protein source and not be burned as an energy source. Number six, take in an adequate amount of dairy products to get enough calcium to keep your bones strong. Number 7, drink plenty of water to aid digestion, prevent constipation, have sufficient blood volume, and cleanse your kidneys. And number 8, consider these principles while managing your fat intake. Take in moderate amounts of fat to promote satiety, to help build cell walls, including brain cells, for absorption of fat-soluble vitamins, for production of hormones. Number 9, allow for some play foods in order to balance your good health with pleasure and satisfaction. Practice the 90-10 formula for feeling good. Let some of your food choices be made for physical health, while some of them are for simple pleasure. Don't be duped by the fat-free trap. Fat-free doesn't mean calorie-free or nutrient-dense. These foods tend to be limited in nutrients while having an overabundance of sugar and salt. Fat-free foods often are not as satisfying as low-fat foods. They also create an illusion of being low-calorie and lead to overconsumption before you know it. Get off the food pedestal. This is number 11. You don't have to be perfect. Honor your health, your taste buds, and your humanness. Now, in pulling this all together, let's go full circle. We began with the concept that most eating disorders represent a lack of trust that the universe will provide what is needed to get through the challenges of this life, which leads to an attempt to both numb these painful feelings and feel some sense of control through the process of trying to control one's food and one's body. We then took a brief look at the eating of a toddler who responds intuitively to his body's signals about food and eating and is not using eating as a coping mechanism. We saw how we can become separated from this experience through life influences and the destructive consequences that can occur as a result of this separation. We examined the role of dieting as a trigger for eating disorders and its paradoxical process of promoting a sense of being out of control while in the attempt of trying to attain control. And finally, I have offered to you the model of intuitive eating as a vehicle to bring you back to that safe place you were in at birth, where you trusted that there would be enough, and eating was something you did because you were hungry, and food was something that nourished you and gave you taste satisfaction. You can find more about intuitive eating in the book Intuitive Eating, St. Martin's Press, 2003, by Evelyn Triboli and Elise Resch. Our time has ended. Thank you for your participation in the lecture entitled Learning to Trust Intuitive Wisdom About Eating, A Nutrition Therapist's Approach to the Healing of Eating Disorders. For further information, you can reach me at 310-551-1999 or my email address, which is eresch@intuitiveeating.org. That's eresch@intuitiveeating.org or the website www.intuitiveeating.org. Thank you.